means everything to bring that trophy home. And yeah, it's been a goal of mine since a very small child to win the Iditarod.
Ryan Reddington is the first in his family to capture the Iditarod crown, fulfilling a lifelong dream. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 14th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski reacts to Interior Secretary Deb Haaland starting a new process to secure a road out of King Cove.
The people of King Cove have been through so much and have been led down a road of false promises for far too long.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland today ended the government's defense of a land exchange agreement that would have allowed the Alaska Peninsula community of King Cove to build a road to reach the all-weather airport. But she committed to a new process and says she really does want to help secure a road for King Cove through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
Haaland's action starts yet another phase in the decades-long effort by the people of King Cove to get a road to Cold Bay, which they say will save lives by allowing people to fly to a hospital even when the weather is bad. Road supporters are hopeful that Haaland is sincere.
We have to believe that she is, and we agreed to work with her on it.
That's King Cove Corporation CEO Della Trumbull, who has lobbied for the road for decades. Trumbull says Haaland explained her decision to local leaders with emotion in her voice. It's personal for Haaland. She's the first Indigenous Secretary of the Interior, and the people of King Cove are primarily Indigenous, too. Senator Lisa Murkowski has championed the project since her early days in Congress. She says she's not sure what to make of Haaland's pledge to help King Cove get a road, which Murkowski says was delivered, quote, with a commitment and a resolve that I had not heard before, unquote. Still, the senator remains wary.
The people of King Cove have been through so much and have been led down a road of false promises for far too long. This cannot be a false promise.
The Interior Department says it intends to initiate an environmental analysis that will, among other things, reconsider the 2013 land exchange that Sally Jewell, an Interior Secretary in the Obama administration, rejected. The Alaska Wilderness League, one of the groups suing to block the Trump administration's land exchange, praised the announcement, as did other environmental groups. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Six conservation groups filed a lawsuit against the federal government today, a day after the Biden administration approved the Willow Project. That's the $8 billion ConocoPhillips oil development located in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. The lawsuit claims federal agencies violated the National Environmental Protection Act by approving Willow because of its potential impacts to sensitive Arctic environments, subsistence users, and climate change. Tim Woody, spokesperson for one of the plaintiffs, the Wilderness Society, appeared on Talk of Alaska today. Woody said Willow runs counter to the administration's goal to cut greenhouse gas emissions by half by 2030.
Part of that means we don't commit to long-term massive oil and gas extraction projects that will drastically increase greenhouse gas emissions over such a long period of time.
Opponents have termed Willow a, quote, carbon bomb. The 600 million barrels of oil it's expected to produce over 30 years equates to adding 2 million cars to the road each year. Many Indigenous groups remain in favor of Willow. Nagara Karcharik is president of Voice of the Arctic Inupiat, based in Utqiagvik. He said on Talk of Alaska he looks forward to economic benefits in the form of jobs and dividends for locals on the North Slope. Karcharik added that he's confident that the project will not threaten subsistence hunting in the area.
The subsistence and Inupiat lifestyle that we live is important. It's the most important for us. So if there was ever a project that we thought would negatively impact that, in ways that would be irreparable, we would not be in support of that project.
The approved version of Willow scaled the project back from 5 drilling pads to 3 to reduce potential impacts to caribou migration and subsistence users, according to the Interior Department. Both Harcharic and Woody expect that ConocoPhillips will begin work to ready the new pads for drilling within the next month. Ryan Reddington is the 2023 champion of the Iditarod. It's a sled dog race that his grandfather started 50 years ago, and he's the first in the family to win. Reddington and his 6 dogs claimed their victory in Nome this afternoon after nearly 9 days of racing. Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan was there and has more on the deep meaning the finish has for the 40-year-old musher.
Ryan Reddington was jubilant coming down Front Street in Nome. He ran alongside his sled, waving to the cheering crowd of a few hundred people. After he crossed the finish line, he pet each of his 6 dogs, he hugged his family, and thanked his fans. Reddington told Iditarod announcer Greg Heister that he had pulled an auspicious message from a fortune cookie before the start of the race.
Your number 5 will be your lucky number for the week, and we drew bib 5.
Reddington says he thought about that fortune every day for the nearly 9 days it took him to complete the 1,000-mile race. And things felt lucky for him even before the race started. He said at a post-race press conference that something felt special about the way his team had been running all year.
Yeah, when we finished runs, they never seem tired, you know, when we finished our training runs.
Reddington's win was particularly significant for the Kinnick-born musher, who now lives part-time in Wisconsin. He grew up in a mushing family, and his dad, uncle, and 2 brothers all completed the Iditarod. His grandfather, Joe Reddington Sr., is considered the father of the race. His bust adorns the bronze trophy that Reddington will receive at the awards banquet later this week.
It means everything to bring that trophy home. And yeah, it's been a goal of mine since a very small child to win the Iditarod, and I can't believe it. It finally happened.
This is Reddington's first win on his 16th try. He ran near the front of the pack most of the race, but midway through the competition when teams hit the Yukon River, he fell behind reigning champ Brent Sass and Jesse Holmes. But things changed. Sass unexpectedly withdrew, citing a bad cold and 3 cracked teeth, and Holmes' team faltered. Reddington saw the opening and surged ahead. He put in a monster run from Caltech to Unalakleet, and again from Koyuk to White Mountain, 95 miles in 14 hours virtually without stopping, to pull ahead of his closest competitor, 2019 champ Pete Kaiser. It worked. When Reddington pulled into one of the final checkpoints in White Mountain for his mandatory 8-hour rest, he had a 4-hour cushion over Kaiser. He says he doubted himself, but the dogs rose to the challenge.
Well, I always do right by the dogs, and if they weren't looking up for that long run, I wasn't going to do it.
He says the final 77 miles to the finish through the notoriously windy Topcock Hills were some of the most challenging of the entire race. Reddington says it was near whiteout conditions.
When we got in the blowhole, there was many times where all I could see was the wheel dogs, and it was marker to marker. Sometimes I'd have to stop, put the snow hook in, and walk away from the team in every direction looking for a trail marker.
Reddington says he didn't panic.
I didn't get excited. I didn't worry about speed. And I talked to the dogs, told them they were doing good.
By the time he crossed the finish line, though, his lead over Kaiser had shrunk from 4 hours to less than an hour and a half. After crossing the finish line in second with his 8 dog team, Kaiser commended Reddington on his race. Kaiser says he and Reddington, along with third place finisher Richie Deal, are close friends, but the competition on the trail was fierce.
There's a lot on the line when you're racing for Iditarod Championship, and there's a lot of pressure and stuff like that. So, you know, and obviously his whole family history and all that plays into it. So I knew he'd be real tough to beat.
Deal finished the race in third place about an hour after Kaiser, rounding out the podium of all Alaska Native mushers. He says in Iditarod's smallest field in race's history, there are bright spots.
It shows that in some parts of Alaska, in rural Alaska, that mushing isn't dying, which is cool.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Lex Trinan.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, forecasting weather in southeast Alaska can be difficult due to the vast differences in landscape, perplexing even meteorologists.
It makes it kind of more of a challenge and more fun. You can nail it and you get it right.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
We've heard about how ConocoPhillips' massive willow project on the North Slope could rejuvenate Alaska's economy, but not so much about Nuiqsut, the community closest to Willow in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. President Biden's approval of the project this week will have huge consequences for Nuiqsut and its 425 people. KNBA's Rhonda McBride gives us a snapshot of a community that could soon be completely surrounded by oil and gas development.
Nuiqsut in Inupiaq means the new horizon. For centuries, its ancestors crisscrossed the eastern side of the North Slope as they migrated to seasonal camps in the Colville River Delta. But in 1973, a group of families came together to form a permanent settlement.
For me, it was a long camping trip.
Leonard Lampe was a child when his family pitched their tent on a bluff that later became known as Nuiqsut. Other white canvas tents dotted the landscape, a community of about 176 people who toughed it out for 2 years until homes could be built, even through the winter when it got down to 55 below.
So I was brought out here when I was 5, and it was a vast, naked land. No streets, no poles, no lights, no housing, nothing.
Lampe says it was almost a magical time in his life.
We had schools in our tents. We had church in our tents. We had outdoor gatherings outside under the stars and under the skylight. So I sensed when I was at that age a very strong sense of community.
Lampe says oil development initially brought a better standard of living.
Warm homes, buildings, recreation center, to see a city hall, to see a clinic. A natural gas station.
Lampe is both a board member and an executive at Kupik, a native corporation with shareholders like Nelly Kaihiluk, who grew up in Nuiqsut's newfound prosperity.
It's a blessing. We're rich in both sides of the world.
Kaihiluk works for the corporation. Her father is the president, who talked with her often when she was young about the trade-offs from development. She was 12 years old when Alpine Field went up near Nuiqsut. She says it not only brought new opportunities to the community, but also gave Nuiqsut the resources to protect what it values the most, subsistence.
You can go upriver and catch a moose and caribou and fish. You can go downriver to catch more fish, whale, bearded seal, ring seals. You can catch birds. It's like one of the most abundant, rich communities I know.
The early settlers specifically chose Nuiqsut for its wealth of wild foods, which some believe development has already jeopardized.
It's kind of disturbing that they would have had and approved it.
Others in the community, like Eunice Brower, who works for the tribe, believe development has caused air pollution and health problems like asthma and introduced toxins into the environment, which will lead to higher cancer rates.
They're not taking that into consideration and how much they're really impacting the health of the people that live there.
Willow will bring miles of new roads and pipelines, as well as 200 oil wells that will forever change the landscape. Environmental groups have called Willow a climate bomb that has the potential to release tons and tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The Kupik Corporation initially opposed Willow, but after years of negotiating with ConocoPhillips, its leaders believe they have found a way to strike the right balance between development and protecting the environment.
It is a motherlode of wealth and a motherlode of impacts.
Andy Mack is Kupik's CEO and was a Department of Natural Resources commissioner under Governor Bill Walker. Based on his experience, he says, with good policies and vigilance, subsistence and development can go hand in hand.
One of the most important things is community members are allowed to get on the road system and to use the road system, which is utilized for oil and gas activity, but for subsistence purposes.
Mack says the corporation has won a number of concessions from ConocoPhillips that ease the impact of development and protects migrating caribou herds and other wildlife. But for better or for worse, Mack says there is one thing everyone in New Ixit can agree upon.
It's hard to overstate the import of this decision because it'll have a permanent impact on the community and our shareholders for the next 100 years.
Mack says it's been a long journey to get to this point, with lots of negotiations and legal hurdles along the way, and likely many more to come. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
In a nondescript office in Juneau, a team of self-described weather nerds works to predict the future. But in Southeast Alaska, they're up against some major challenges. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
Weather forecasting is notoriously hard to get right. No one knows that better than National Weather Service meteorologist Grant Smith.
I remember this very vividly because it was like at this moment, I just like, all right, I give up. It was one time I was standing at my house looking outside and it was 34 and raining. And I was just drinking my coffee. Later that afternoon, it was 38 and snowing. And I was like, what is this? What is this? It's just a moving target.
Smith came to the Weather Service office in Juneau after working as a TV meteorologist in South Dakota. He says forecasting there was a little more straightforward.
South Dakota is mostly flat. Just because it's flatter, the range of possibilities is much smaller. And so it's just, in a sense, easier to forecast.
The basic components of weather forecasts are the same no matter where you are. It starts with radar and satellite imagery that show the basics of incoming weather systems. Things like what direction a front is traveling and how much precipitation it's bringing. Then weather models bring out the finer details. They basically run simple atmospheric data through equations that predict things like wind speed, dew point, and temperature. And those tools work really well in some regions. But in a place like Southeast Alaska, things are more complicated.
Ours is a lot more intricate in needing to know these tiny little details and microclimates that we have to deal with.
Basically, what's happening in the atmosphere doesn't always give a clear picture of what's happening on the ground. Weather systems interact with the terrain. And the many mountains and waterways of Southeast Alaska make things hard. Take Hoonah and Gustavus. They're fairly close to each other, but the same wind pattern can cause very different weather in each place.
So you have a north wind. So north wind for Gustavus is coming off of land, probably going to be cold, probably going to be snow. But a north wind over Hoonah is coming off of water, rain, snow mix, or rain.
Those differences define microclimates in Southeast. They're small areas where the climate patterns differ from the rest of the region, and even Juneau has a handful of distinct microclimates. On a winter day, storm clouds coming in off the ocean can hit Douglas Island and dump rain in downtown Juneau. But if you drive out to the valley, in the shadow of Mendenhall Glacier, you might encounter fresh white snow instead. Meteorologist Nicole Farron says the models predict weather conditions for areas that are just 3 square kilometers. But even in that small grid, Juneau's terrain can change from land to ocean to high mountain peaks.
Majority of this box is a mountain, and the models think that that is a mountain point. They don't know that Home Depot's right there. But I do.
So on the forecast map, she'll edit weather conditions by hand. It's not just microclimates. Southeast Alaska is also a huge region.
Our area is about the size of Florida, and Florida has 6 or 7 offices, and we have 1.
And not all the meteorologists have a chance to visit the many small communities they forecast for. So they turn to the people that live there.
People that are weather nerds like the rest of us here in the building, and they like weather, so they report on it.
They can tell meteorologists what will happen on the ground when a weather system moves over the land. If a front passes over Gustavus, for instance, local observers have an idea of what's going to happen in Juneau. In most cases, forecasters make their decision with an abundance of caution, especially when making storm advisories and warnings. They make the forecasts for safety purposes, so they're bound to overpredict. But Smith says an accurate forecast in a place like Southeast is a unique rush.
It makes it kind of more of a challenge and more fun when you can nail it and when you get it right.
And he says the people of Southeast are uniquely forgiving, too. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, offering guests hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and the Red Lantern Steak and Spirits Restaurant. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com. Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
The only Cook Inlet beluga whale in captivity is celebrating 5 years at his aquarium home. KDLL's Riley Board has this update on Tyonic, named after the closest community to where he was rescued, who first lived at the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward before transferring to his permanent home at SeaWorld San Antonio.
In 2017, the pilot of an Alaska State Trooper helicopter spotted a stranded beluga calf from the air on a mudflat near Trading Bay on the west side of Cook Inlet. The pilot was out looking for another dead whale that had been reported on the west side when he spotted the calf.
He was flying and he saw what he thought was a dead baby beluga. So he knew we would be very interested in a dead animal, and that's what it looked like from the air.
That's Barbara Mahoney, a biologist with NOAA Fisheries who worked on the rescue. She says the pilot landed, realized the calf was alive but abandoned, and contacted NOAA Fisheries. The team quickly realized Tyonic would need to remain in captivity. He was too weak and young to survive on his own. He was brought first to Anchorage, then to the Sea Life Center in Seward.
Even with the health challenges, I mean, they rallied, he rallied, and after a couple months, we realized that it looked like he was over the hump for the most part, and NOAA did evaluation and realized that this animal couldn't be rehabilitated and released back to the wild.
Cook Inlet beluga whales are genetically distinct and highly endangered. There are roughly 270 that inhabit the waterway today. Tyonic was the first rehabilitated Cook Inlet beluga calf and remains the only Cook Inlet beluga in captivity. Beyond caring for the animal, researchers also appreciated the opportunity to study a member of the species.
Caring for stranded animals isn't just about caring for stranded animals. It's an opportunity to learn about the species and the pressures going on in the population in the wild. We have definitely learned a lot from him.
In an episode of Indie Alaska made in those first few months when Tyonic lived at the Sea Life Center, Dr. Carrie Gertz explains that the center was able to conduct the first ever hearing tests on a Cook Inlet beluga.
This is the first beluga from Cook Inlet that we've been able to do a hearing test on. But it's also important for the greater population, for scientists and resource managers, because one of the concerns of what might be a pressure to the Cook Inlet beluga whales is their ability to hear in what's a very noisy environment.
After 4 months in Seward, NOAA selected SeaWorld San Antonio as Tyonic's permanent home, because the facility had adult female belugas and young male calves, which would be important for his development. In San Antonio, Tyonic bonded with a Pacific white-sided dolphin named Betty, and they remained companions until her death last year. Mahoney says Tyonic's 5-year anniversary is significant, as were all his previous milestones. On the Kenai Peninsula, I'm Riley Board.
Some Alaskans recognized a familiar face on stage at the 95th Annual Academy Awards on Sunday night. An actor born and raised in Ketchikan was celebrating their movie's big win. Tally Madell co-starred in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which took home a total of 7 Oscars, including Best Picture. KRBD's Reagan Miller caught up with the actor.
Even before Oscar night, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once had already won a bevy of awards, like an Outstanding Cast Award from the Screen Actors Guild, 2 Golden Globes, and a Writers Guild of America Award. According to IGN, even before the Oscars, it had already claimed the title of Most Awarded Movie Ever. So, co-star Tally Madell was hopeful the streak would continue on Oscar night. The movie had already racked up 6 awards by the time Harrison Ford came out on stage to present the award for Best Picture. After all, their co-star Ki-Hoi Kwan, who some might remember as Data from The Goonies, had acted alongside Ford in an Indiana Jones movie decades ago, and Madel took it as a sign.
We, at that point, had already won so many awards besides these Oscars, too. So leading up to the Best Picture announcement, it seemed clear that we were poised to win.
And they did. Everything Everywhere All at Once, an A24 film that premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival last year, won Best Picture. It beat out competition like Top Gun Maverick, Avatar, The Way of Water, and Elvis. In total, the movie earned 7 Oscars. Madel says it was overwhelming to look out from the stage as producer Jonathan Wang accepted the Best Picture Oscar.
I didn't look at the audience much because I think I might have, collapsed from seeing so many, the faces of artists that I've always looked up to and admired.
But Madel says the win just felt right. They played the part of Becky, girlfriend to the character Joy Wang, played by Stephanie Hsu. Here they are quipping to Wang's parents, Evelyn and Waymond, in the first few minutes of the movie.
I always learn something when I hang out with the elderly. Old people are very wise.
Madel's character struggles to be accepted by her girlfriend's parents, who immigrated from China, and her traditional grandfather, who Joy's parents don't want to know they're dating. It's one of the struggles that contributes to Joy's character being taken over by a force from another universe and kind of going off the deep end and creating an everything bagel that could wreak havoc.
You know why I actually built the bagel? It wasn't to destroy everything. It was to destroy myself.
The movie is a fast-paced sci-fi that follows Joy's mother as she jumps through bizarre and absurd universes, trying to reconcile the things that could have been if her life had been different. In some worlds, she's a martial arts pro. In others, a movie star. In some, she divorces her husband or never moves to America. Madel explains it like this.
I think a message that we can roll in for this time that's from the film is nothing matters. But that also means that we can do anything we want. It's ours to create and it's ours to heal.
Between Oscar night and the various after parties, Madel says it's been a whirlwind.
It's been absolutely surreal. I'm so happy for everybody and I'm so honored.
Madel remembers taking classes at the Ketchikan Theater Ballet and performing with First City Players. Madel says they owe a lot to this town of nearly 14,000.
And Alaska has just so many amazing artists. Aren't we so lucky?
They hope to visit again soon. They were in town last summer teaching classes with First City Players. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online, alaskapublic.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Kavitha George and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Lex Trinan in Nome, Anna Caney in Juneau, Riley Board in Kenai, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer. I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
And by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.